Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Megan Karnickius, who is the author of A Deeper Perspective on Alzheimer's and Other Dementias. Megan is an RN, as well as a licensed nursing home administrator and massage therapist. And she has written a very interesting book on perspectives of Alzheimer's. These are perspectives that I have also shared in my career as a plastic surgeon, because we're often asked to see patients in nursing homes with pressure sores. And I'll share my experience a little bit later in the show, but many of her observations are also my observations over the years in terms of the deeper meaning of this disease and what we can do to help these people. Thanks, Megan, for joining us.
Thank you.
So would you like to give the listening audience a little bit of your background and how you became interested in Alzheimer's? I also wanted to mention that I attended several meetings with anthroposophical medicine groups, so I'm familiar with that approach as well.
Right, okay. So I grew up in a household with a disabled younger sister, and I was about 5 years old when she was born. And when my parents, when my sister was seven, they sat us down and we had a family meeting, and my mother felt that we were all brought together for a purpose, and that my sister had a whole spirit and she was having a handicapping experience, and that we needed, in the roles that we were in, to try to do our best to help her shine through, to gain whatever experience she was meant to gain, to help her achieve the best that she could. And it was such an interesting way of thinking about it, because it created a kind of peership. And that the true tragedy would have been if we were feeling awful about it and feeling like this was such a sad thing, this shouldn't have happened. But instead what happened was every soul is learning something, every soul is working on things at a different level, and we may not always understand it in our day-to-day ongoings, but there's something that we can tap into that gives us that kind of insight and strength and endurance with things that are challenging. And so I found it really helpful, and I kind of looked at illness in that way, that there's something that people are working on that we may not understand. No one wants Alzheimer's consciously. They don't intentionally want it, but sometimes when we end up having these kinds of challenges in our life, they're fallout blessings. They're things that happen that we would have never understood had we not had this very challenging situation. And I really believe that people continue to have a whole spirit, and that we're not defined by the matter of our brain, we're defined by our essence, and that essence is very active throughout our life. And so that's part of the philosophy I've tried to share in the book. And we had a family physician that was a medical director for an anthroposophical residential community, a Camp Hill community that applied Waldorf ideas to special needs children. And I ended up working there, and saw an amazing massage technique taught there, and that led me to getting my nursing degree in order to be able to go study in Europe and study in that program in Germany. And then when I came back to the United States, I moved to Boulder because of the massage school that was here, was renowned at that point, and was able to get into school. And so I worked as a nurse. And I was working in nursing homes that had no specialized training, no programs for people with dementia. And I just felt this strong pull and connection to them, and felt like we needed to advocate in different ways. And then had the good fortune of being able to open the first secure memory care unit in Boulder County in 1989. And then they pretty much held on to me. So my whole career has been working with helping people understand how to work with people with this concern, how to design buildings and programs that work for them. Mm-hmm. And I really love this population. I feel like they're brave, brave individuals and very, very dear.
I wanted to give you some information that I've come across. It may help you in your understanding of causation of at least some of Alzheimer's and treatment and even prevention. I had the, the experience of going to several clairvoyants. Of course, I do this radio show for the last 20 years, so I'm often interviewing very high-level clairvoyants all over the world, and often they give me little private readings. And there was a pattern of in the reading that I was at risk for Alzheimer's. And so I went and did some exploration around that and found Dr. Overman. He's a naturopath. He's passed on, but he's a naturopath in Ohio that actually had a treatment for Alzheimer's, specifically the Alzheimer's that comes from prion disease. The information that we have is that up to 75% of the people in the U.S. have been exposed to prion disease by eating meat that is tainted. And, in fact, Europe won't accept our meat because they know it's tainted. And people who have immune deficiencies, I had mycoplasma, which creates an immune deficiency, as well as silicone toxicity, which also creates an immune deficiency. I had 30 grams of silicone leak out of one of my implants and create a significant T-cell immunity deficiency. So here I was at risk for Alzheimer's. And so I was am currently treating myself, and have treated myself in the past intermittently when I'm guided to, with an herbal substance called Prionex, and also the harmonic quad, which is like a zapper, an electromagnetic device that actually somehow decreases the risk of Alzheimer's. But it may do it not by affecting the prion so much, but by keeping the mycoplasma in check. So I've treated a number of people throughout my career in prevention of Alzheimer's. And what's so interesting is my cousin recently had a real bad problem with prion disease, Jacob Creutzfeldt disease, and he was actually diagnosed before his death at Hopkins. And so I discovered that I was exposed and my cousins were exposed at the same time, so I was exposed very young for this bad meat. And so basically, if we can determine that somebody's at risk for this, it can be treated by treating the underlying immune problem as well as taking Prionex from Dr. Overman. And then there's a second form of Alzheimer's that is common, and that's bad fish. I don't know if you've read in Discovery magazine, but they had an island of natives that were eating bats, and the bats were eating bad fish, which were eating cyanobacter, a form of algae, and it concentrated a chemical in their brain, and most of the people on the island got Alzheimer's. So that's like a clinical form of Alzheimer's from a substance that really could be detoxed. So I emailed Dr. Staninger, who's one of the nation's best toxicologists, and told her about it. And so I think, you know, we need to get people looking at the detox for this chemical in the brain. She said it is possible. It's going to take some money to get it done. And if you like, I can put you in touch with her. And perhaps if you've got any fundraising ability, we can try to get the detox for that particular chemical. My suggestion is that people out there use a pendulum, learn pendulum techniques, yes and no, in terms of whether or not they're at risk and then whether or not to eat certain fish and meat. You know, I mean, it's mostly red meat for the prion disease. You can also be exposed to prions in surgery. A letter from Emory went out not too long ago to many patients who'd had surgery at Emory saying that they had had an incident where somebody with prion disease had had neurosurgery, and even sterilizing the instruments doesn't kill the prion. So it's a very, very strange disease, but unfortunately you can be exposed during surgery if those instruments had been unknowingly contaminated by somebody's brain. It's mostly in brain surgery that the instruments would be contaminated, but then anywhere in the body that they're used later on, say the neurosurgical instruments are used in another part of the body, you can probably get exposed to prion disease. So this is a very strange disease. And it's not usually, I mean, those two are probably specific types. Many, many types are vascular, as you said in your book. Many types are, you know, a slow vascular assault to the brain from high blood pressure or from other things that are causing nitric oxide problems. So that's a different disease. But the Alzheimer's that you talk about that is relentless in your book is probably either the fish or the meat. So we need, and that's why there's not a, necessarily a genetic component, is because it's an environmental exposure in somebody with an immune deficiency.
Yeah, I don't get into the treatment aspects in terms of it's so vast, and I have a naturopathic friend in Germany who's also an osteopath, and he has been sending me information every week on, you know, complementary therapy and other approaches to working with this challenge. And when you go into, there are up to 20 years of changes in the brain before you have outward signs of Alzheimer's, it's, mm-hmm. it's really tricky, this idea of when are you tipping into it and what can you do to bring yourself back out of it. And you had support and assistance with identifying something probably pretty early so that you mm-hmm. could redirect it. And the challenge is that there's a certain amount of physical matter change that happens over time that we can't sometimes, you know, we can't bring it back to a healthy state. And we're seeing
that's
a lot more,
true.
You
yeah.
know, younger onset folks that are under the age of 65, and that's stunning. And they do feel that there's more of a genetic component with that group, and they are working on, you know, identifying the pathways and then what are the ways that we could help people not have the gene kind of turn on that mm-hmm. makes protein amyloid plaques lay down, that makes neurofibril tangles happen, that makes atrophy in the brain, you know, happen. And so all of those things kind of cascade, and I think it's marvelous, you know, if people are working on in whatever field they're in and what their knowledge of, like, immunology is or, you know, cardiovascular disease or whatever. The fact that we have the technology we do with computers and, you know, their groups, there's a brain consortium that will encourage different groups and different silos to share their information. So if someone's working on MS somewhere and somebody else is working on Parkinson's, well, let's discover together what you guys are finding, because you may help us, we may help you. And so I, you know, it's so huge, such a big wave that's coming with all the baby boomers getting older, and the vulnerability to getting these diseases increases as you age. So when somebody's 85 or over, they have a 50% chance of tipping into this. And if we could figure out, as you said, what are some things to, you know, work with in your diet, in your immune health, in the way that you're living, what kind of support you have, you know, if we could prevent some of that, I mean, we all want that. What I tried mm-hmm. to really focus on is also when people have the disease, people are at a loss as to how to treat them in terms of social and psychosocial support and dealing with some of the challenges that come up with behaviors and communication, and how to really, from compassion, from a place of really observing and looking at things in terms of what can I learn also from being with this person, how am I in this circumstance, why did this happen to me, and really be able to gain some insight from that, as well as really being able to support the person who has the disease. Because I think sometimes, you know, people can sit around and wring their hands or avoid, you know, not really engage something because they're afraid of it. And if you help people understand how to work with someone who has this challenge, all of a sudden, all these things open up, and it's really still our love and caring that's being expressed that's so important.
Right. I want to mention one more study before we go into speaking. I'd like to go through the four stages of Alzheimer's because I think it's important to recognize that there are different stages, and especially the early stages, because you could have family members entering into those and recognizing that's important. I did want to mention one study that they did in the nuns that was very interesting. They they looked at a whole group of nuns and found there were two things that kind of separated those that, you know, developed Alzheimer's-like syndrome from those that didn't. And it was folate intake and also keeping your mind active. And I think you made a good point in your book that you've taken care of all of these really brilliant people who've kept their mind active but still got Alzheimer's. So obviously not all Alzheimer's respond to keeping your mind active, and some are very relentless. Probably the prion disease type is not gonna respond to keeping your mind active because it's more of a infection. But the folate thing is interesting. I think folate deficiency is very common because about 30% of us have MTHFR or methylation defects, and we can't methylate folate. So the folic acid we take in doesn't get methylated unless there's methyl groups available, which people don't really have in their supplements unless they know about it. And so I think that becoming aware of that taking methylfolate may help some people not have the problem. I think that's important to let people know as well.
And the other thing with the nun study that was so fantastic was he found the handwritten notes when they had first made their commitment to doing this path, and they would have to send that into the church. And as a scientist, being able to have such a large group of people that had lived in very similar ways, ate a very similar diet, and led very similar career and kind of faith-based support, you know, they had that, all of that integrated. And then he found these letters, and when they were sending the brains from the nuns to an independent lab, there were some results that were very consistent with what they expected. The person was, you know, beginning to fail, having some challenges, and they would see those changes in the brain. But there were also some very odd circumstances that happened where they sent a brain off, and they get this report back that the brain is in very good condition, very good health, and they had been witnessing pretty advanced challenges and problems the person was having. And then they had other circumstances where they would send a brain off and it looked riddled with disease, and yet the person's functional level when they were interacting with them had been quite high. And that was part of what reinforced the idea of brain plasticity, and that those folks, when they read the letters, had what was called idea density. So when they had written a sentence, you know, someone would say, oh, I was born as the sun was rising into the loving embrace of my three siblings and my mother and father in Cork, Ireland, whereas someone else said, I was born in 1863 in Cork, Ireland. And the person who had the idea density seemed to have protection against the disease ravages really showing up in their functional life. Like, they had compensatory abilities and options, that their brain was still running circuits in ways the person who had written this very simple sentence did not have. And so they realized, oh, what is it about how we develop our brains that can create that protection and also that functional ability? So that was a fantastic study.
Yeah, it really was. And you know, there could also be something, a toxic illness like the one from Cyanobacter is going to have very different physical signs in the brain than, say, an infectious one will with prion disease, you see? Because prion disease is actually, what, malfolding of proteins. So you know that that's going to have a structural effect on the brain. Mm-hmm. Whereas a toxin, I mean, you can poison somebody with arsenic and have not that many physical signs of it. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, it disrupts things at a metabolic level, but it may not disrupt things at a physical level.
Right.
That you can actually see. So I think that we need to keep in mind that, and then, of course, the vascular cause will show up. I mean, that causes microinfarcts. Mm-hmm. So that's going to really cause bad physical problems. When you're killing off parts of the brain, and then you may or may not have the ability through the plasticity of of recreating the memory pathways, you know. Memory pathways are not in one area of the brain, you know, they're not like in the frontal cortex or something. Memory patterns exist holographically in the brain, and that's why people can have a large amount of brain injury and still have memories. And it's a very different thing than what you might assume.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, let's go ahead and talk about the different stages of Alzheimer's. Would you like to talk about the early stage? Because this is something I think we all need to know about.
Great. So what I did working with people over the years was really look at developmental theory, and that when people are coming into this disease process, they tend to lose the last thing they developed in their life. So early stage is the loss of adult learning. So when you think about the ability to handle your finances in an appropriate way, to drive your car safely, to make executive decisions or judgments with really good rationale behind what you're doing, that we see people with the early stage of Alzheimer's start having impacts in those areas. And it affects the hippocampus, which is the area of the brain where short-term memory gets converted. So there's this ability for people in early stage to have very accurate memory long-term. They can tell you all kinds of stories from historical things in their life, and they're pretty accurate. But they start faltering on things like, did I just take that supplement or pill? Did I just talk to my daughter? Did I go to that appointment yesterday? And what you see happening is short-term memory really structures us. It helps us engage. It helps us eat, bathe, do all these functional things. And when you have short-term memory loss, you tend to go on your long-term memory, which informs you, well, of course I bathed. I've always bathed. Of course I ate this morning. I always eat every morning, when in actuality that may not have happened. And so sometimes people have insights, they're aware that something's not right, they may themselves seek out some assistance or help in finding out what's going on, and other people don't have insight, and they tend to feel like people are sort of arraigning against them, like that they're, the family member that has insight, who's aware that things aren't going on, and they're trying to convey it to that person, and that person starts feeling really kind of invaded and told what to do and gets upset about it. So it can be something where sort of the ego and the sense of defense really comes up. And so how do you try to bridge to the person in a way that works for them? And some couples, for example, the spouse will say, you know what, I'm really having problems with my memory. I want to go to the doctor, but I'm afraid. Can you come with me? And they bring the spouse, who actually has the issue, but they act as if they're the ones who need support. And so they go to the physician, and then while they're there, they get a neuro exam, and the other person is participating and gets it too. And so there are some ways around it when people are really resistant and having a hard time, but it takes some creativity. And all the things about, you know, exercise and good diet and all of that really can help people have a better quality of life, first of all, but then also, you know, the question of, does it help extend the time that people are really functional? And I think it's an important thing to look at. And the early stage can last, Alzheimer's overall can last 2 to 25 years. The average is 8 to 12 years. So often people are managing okay, living independently, and starting to have some challenges and issues, but you may be looking at needing a bit more support, you know, 2 years into it, 4 years into it for sure. So that early stage can be, you know, 2 to 4 years pretty commonly, where you're noticing these things are changing. The Alzheimer's Associations and the Alzheimer and Dementia Foundation of America both are groups that have a lot of support and can help families, and also trying to find the right physician, the right folks that maybe would come in and help in the home, or adult daycare settings that might come later. It's nice to get prepared and sort of get your ducks in a row. So if families haven't worked out powers of attorney or haven't written their will or haven't sort of addressed those things, it's a really important time when somebody's in an earlier stage because they can say what they want and how they feel, whereas later word finding can get affected and people can have a hard time expressing themselves, and you want to try to get these things addressed before you're there.
Yeah, that's true. And then the second stage, would you like to describe that?
Yeah, so I equate the second stage with the loss of adolescent learning. So when you think about when you were younger and you're beginning to explore, who am I going to be? What's the career I want to get into? How do I feel about my relationships? And then that emotional sort of feeling that adolescents can have where they're, you know, trying to rein in instant gratification and be patient, but they tend to be really enthusiastic. And they might still be learning tact and manners and sort of how to interface with other people. And if that's a successful stage in their life, you know, they feel like they can go out in the world and they're ready for that. There's some elders who, certainly in the generations that we saw before, who had parents that were very, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child, child should be seen and not heard, where we had some elders who actually never had a chance to rebel and have faith that they were still going to be loved. And so sometimes we see people revisit things in their past when they're harvesting their long-term memory. It's like they step into it and they're projecting that perception out on the world around them. And so we'll see people trying to resolve things from their life that weren't resolved, that weren't addressed, or experiences that they had. And this can also be in an earlier stage where, you know, something didn't go well, and they're moving towards the end of their life, and they're needing an opportunity to kind of expunge or vent or process things that weren't processed in a way before. And so people can get very emotional. Their moods can be more labile. They can lose their impulse control and their tact, so they can say things or do things that might be a little bit outrageous. And so families and friends and people working with that, you know, what's a way that you can help navigate through that process and help someone really resolve some things or feel differently? There's also a shift in that stage from reality orientation to what's called validation therapy. And so when an elder in early stages is saying, where are we going? What time are we going? What time is the appointment? When are we leaving? Where are we going? And the person's repeating because their short-term memory, it doesn't allow what you said to sink in. And right. So the caregiver has to be very, you know, take a deep breath, just know that this person's trying as hard as they can. They really want the information, but they can't remember. And then what shifts later is people will say, where's my mother? I need to find my mother. And you know you're looking at someone 90 and their mother has passed. And you have to make this call of what is it about this question that I can respond to. So I might say, you know, I haven't seen your mom. Is there something I can do for you? Because sometimes people, when they move into the later stages of the disease, they use a lot of free association. And so a mother is symbolic for, it's a person who can help me. It's a person who solves problems. It's a person who loves me that I'm connected to, and I'm feeling disconnected. I want to be with people who love me. And the last thing might be, I wasn't there when she was really ill. I was raising my own children, and I couldn't get to her. And here's this elder worried about, where is my mother? I can't find her. And it's really coming from a genuine sort of psychological need to express and resolve that. And so if she responds when I say, can I help you with something? Oh, yeah, I was looking for my shoes or my purse, I can't find it. I can respond to that. If the person's saying, I miss her, I love her, and I can talk about how much I'm happy to be with this person, and I'm so glad they're here, and I really enjoy being with them too, and I miss my own mom, and we can sort of reminisce in a way that supports what that person's feeling. And then if they really are genuinely upset about where is my mother and what's going on with that, then we can try to talk about it in a way like, where is she? What's happening? And not immediately pull the carpet out from under her and say, you know, she's dead and we need to go to lunch, which was a terrible way of approaching elders. And I know that sometimes people get confused about, am I lying? And it's like, what's the kindest thing? What's the gentlest thing? And also, what's honoring the truth? So wherever somebody is, how can we help them move through that in a way that we aren't creating grief over and over again?
Right, yeah.
You know?
And one of the things you say in your book is, if I see her, I'll tell her you're looking for her or something like
right.
that.
Right. And I'll come running. I will come and look for you. If I actually see her, I am definitely going to come
That's
find
right.
you and tell you.
Yeah, and tell you where she is, right. Yeah. Yeah. And then I guess the later stages,
the loss of childhood learning.
Right.
So that how things function. How do I do this task? How do I dress? How do I bathe? How do I use the bathroom? You know, what am I doing in this situation? How do I connect to that? And so that's when you see people really struggling with restlessness, focus. They have a short attention span. They really start shifting into nonverbal communication more. They have a lot of difficulty with word finding and being able to express. You have expressive aphasia as well as receptive aphasia. And then you have all these graces of, like, what did we love in childhood? And sensory experiences and animals and children and music, all of those things, they really love. They really connect through those vehicles. And so if we can work with sensory experiences and touch and, you know, make the bath feel like a massage with your hand in one of those pocket washcloths, and you do all the strokes mm-hmm. with the soap and the water as if you were massaging them, and they just love that. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, how do you shift into how would I perceive the world if I was a younger person growing up, and this mm-hmm. person is revisiting all of that in reverse, and so they're beginning to lose that. So you see people struggling with fine motor. So when you think about development as an infant, you're flat on the planet, and you have this thing orbiting, your hand is moving over you, and you don't realize you're connected to it. And then you realize you are, and you start reaching, and you use a palmar grasp, and then you differentiate, and you do a pincer grasp. And so what we see with elders in this loss of childhood and the transition to loss of infant is losing fine motor first, so they're really struggling with buttoning their shirts and you need to help, or tying their shoe. But they can still bowl, they can dance, they can go for long walks, but they're really struggling at meals, trying to use utensils, and so we switch to things that they can pick up and hold so that they can continue to try to feed themselves. We have a therapeutic alpaca that comes and visits our building, and it's so sweet. It walks up to everyone. It rubs its face on your cheek. You can put your arms around it and hug it, and mm-hmm. our folks that are really in that nonverbal phase love being able to interact with the animals, and we go to a farm, and so we've had people riding horses and visiting cows and chickens and lambs and goats and doing different things like that, and you just have a whole group of people that love that. They're still very present and connected, and they sitting outside in the sunshine, you know, having a light breeze and just enjoying that. And so families have to kind of adjust and learn how to be with the person in a more nonverbal way, and come with their presence and their being, their sense of being, and be calm. And then there's some, you know, way of connecting if we can manage that. So all that busy, frenetic doing sometimes starts slowing down in this phase. You may have some people that still walk a lot and do laps, but they may be taking rest more often and things like that. And then when you have the last stage, it's the loss of infant learning. And so not being able to control your balance, your bodily functions, really needing a lot of physical support. So it's a very physical stage. And I always think about a monk in deep meditation, and that I've been put in charge of their body while they're visiting these very deep inner places, and they still have some connection to this life because they're still with us. And so how can we really honor that and allow and not have judgment around it? Somewhat like thinking of tethered angels, like they're somehow here and they're somehow there, and the threshold is very thin for them, and they have good eye contact at times. You can feel that lucidity that has gone throughout the disease. You have periods of confusion and periods of lucidity, and even at this very late stage, you can have people that you feel sort of clear for a little bit and connect to you. And I've had people that, as they're dying, and really in the terminal phase of the disease, able to say things, able to recognize people, talk to people, and that's been sort of a furthering in my sense of it, is that there's always that sense of I am-ness or that higher self, mm-hmm. that full spiritual being that's absolutely whole and connecting to this experience. But because the vehicle of the brain really causes damage to being able to access all your files, I don't know why we jump so quickly to the files are gone rather than the files are just not available.
Well, I wanted to share several experiences I had with late-stage Alzheimer's patients in nursing homes. Of course, we're called in to take care of a pressure sore, which is kind of it's a problem for the people caring for them, and it's a threat to their health. But in terms of the money it's going to require to fix it and the high rate of failure and everything else, you know, I was just guided to deal with it in a different way. And so what I did was communicate with the person on a more of a telepathic way. And what I found when I was doing that, I would go in and ask them, you know, what's happening with them and what did they want. And a lot of times they would tell me that they wanted to die, but they were very afraid to die because they didn't know what was going to be there. And some people are afraid to die because they believe for certain reasons they might go to hell or
right.
they might be stuck in purgatory. You know, there's religious ideas involved. And so I've done this radio show for 20 years, and I've interviewed all of the people on near-death experiences and all of the people on, you know, the books that are written about communication of people that have passed on and what's really happening, and the psychologist who hypnotized 1,000 people between lives, and they all say virtually the same thing. So, you know, we're pretty sure scientifically that we know what happens between lives, and based on this big wealth of information that mm-hmm. is out there. And I'm sure you've read a lot of the same books that I've interviewed the authors on.
Mm-hmm.
So basically I would tell them what happens to you when you die, you know, because there's certain stages you go through, and that you have a life review, and then you meet with your team and your advisors about what you're going to do next, and a lot of times you're a guide for someone who's still here. Other times you plan what you're going to do when you come back, and there's other things you can do too. But I would explain all this to them, and then usually within 72 hours they would go ahead and die, and then I wouldn't have to worry about fixing their pressure sore. And so that's the kind of thing that I found, that at least in some late stage Alzheimer's, and it might not be every type of Alzheimer's, but at least in some late stages, there can be a fear of death that can be handled on the higher planes, like telepathically and
right.
and in a way that allows them to pass on without so much fear and uncertainty.
Right, and I've also experienced that there's someone in their karmic sort of family group that's still needing them to be here. That's another reason I see strongly
yeah.
being played out, is that one of the family members really genuinely isn't ready.
Can't let them go.
Wait.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
wait. They like, okay, I can hang in. I can still
yeah.
be in this physical plane if you need me to. And then
right.
another thing I see sometimes is people not having enough energetic force to kind of bounce out. And mm-hmm. that sometimes a crisis, you know, like they have a fall and then things happen and everybody's mobilized around them and everyone's coming into town and they're trying to figure out what to do, and then you see the person leave. It's like the extra force, the extra energy of everyone coming together helps them be able to make that transition too.
Yeah, I had an experience like that. I had a, I was taking care of a 80-some-year-old gentleman who fell, and he had a fractured neck and a fractured face. And of course, the fractured neck fortunately didn't require surgery, but we didn't want to rush him right into surgery with a fractured neck before neurosurgery had, given their blessing for us to fix his facial fracture. So I went in, saw him late at night, and I was guided to give him a healing. And the healing, just is energy, as you know. And then I was told as I walked out of the hospital that that would be used for his transition, which was surprising to me because he wasn't sick. I mean, he wasn't, he looked fine.
Right.
His vital signs were stable and his labs were all good and he was talking to me normally. But then when I went back the next day to see him, he had passed during the night. So that extra energy is sometimes used for transition.
Yeah, and I think some families experience that phenomena. We had a fall ball last night at my building, and everyone dresses up, and we dance and dance and dance, and all the elders are having a great time, and there are people that normally are somewhat reticent or shy, and they're participating, and family members come, and it's just a lovely evening. And there was a son with his mom, and so his wife was there, and there were a couple cousins visiting, so her sister's kids were there. And she was regaling them with stories. She was talking more than she had spoken in the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And they were enthralled. They were totally excited. And I really feel, your Akka threads, your connections, the lines that we have between us, when you tighten them around a circle and you have people more focused in the same physical space, they can access things in their own memory and things that they don't normally have the conduit to because you're lending it to them. And it was so fun to watch them in their joy and then having this really good time dancing, and then they're, for his mom to be just teasing and joking and calling forth stuff that she hasn't talked about in years.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
And that's good for their memories, too, without that. I mean, we don't storytell and share our experiences. There was just so many things that we're too busy. I mean, we're just too busy to share those things that probably should be shared. The wisdom.
And I think that's another gift of Alzheimer's, actually, because, there are many fallout blessings of situations like this. And having people get the family member to tell their stories when they're still able to, and then be able to tell the stories back to them when they're no longer able to, and that life history is really preserved and the family's taken the time to focus on it, share it again, and that person is really allowed to have opportunities to think about things in a different way and have that biography really living for them.
Yeah, and there's some real amazing stuff that happens at the end of life. My grandmother was 97 when she passed, and that year I remember visiting with her, and, she had long since forgotten who my mother was, who visited her every day, but when I came into the room, she knew my name, and she knew I was a doctor, which didn't help mother very much because she didn't appreciate not being recognized. But grandmother would recite long poems by completely correctly from her probably teenage years, and but she couldn't remember anything else. But she could remember these poems. I mean, you just wonder where in the brain that stuff is coming from.
Right.
It's just incredible to hear a 97-year-old recite things verbatim, very long poems, and yet, not being able to recognize her own daughter.
Right, and I worry about our generations coming up because we did not have to learn how to do that. and their elders mm-hmm. that can really receive the blessing of, hey, my memory's okay. I remember the Gettysburg Address.
Right.
You know, I can say these things. And that, what are we going to be doing? We didn't have to do that in our educational
mm-mm.
experience. And it's something that these elders really get to tap into and enjoy. You know, so it just makes me a little wistful. I guess we'll be going around with headsets with, like, Rolling Stones playing, but...
Yeah, right. We'll be doing the Rolling Stones. Rolling Stones. That's funny. That might be true. Yeah, that's... Well, hopefully elder care will be different in the future.
Yes, I hope it is, too. Yeah.
Well... we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Yes. So my name again is Megan Carnarius, and I have a website that's megancarnarius.com, and the book's title is A Deeper Perspective on Alzheimer's and Other Dementias, Practical Tools with Spiritual Insight, and it was published by Findhorn Press this past April, and it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Findhorn's website. There are a lot of bookstores, when I've checked, in different places that are carrying it. So that's a way to get the book. And I really appreciate you inviting me to speak with you, and thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. And I would encourage people who have anyone in their family that is facing any of the memory loss illnesses. Alzheimer's is kind of a bucket term. It's probably a number of different illnesses, but memory loss is part of aging. If you live long enough, I think most people at the end of their life have some form of memory loss if they don't die of some other illness. It probably is just some form. I'm not talking about severe memory loss, but some form mm-hmm. of memory loss occurs probably because of nutritional and structural changes that are part of aging itself. So we all will experience something of that if we live long enough. And this book is a great resource for anyone dealing with family members with these challenges. So. I would, it's a wealth of information. So, Megan, thank you very much for joining us today. We will be coming back next week with Emotion and Healing in the Energy Body by Robert Henderson. And then Donnie Yance on the 21st, Adaptogens and Medical Herbalism. And then David Asprey, the movie Moldy. It's about mold exposure on the 28th. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.